You can hold off on the tape for a minute because I think we probably... I put Windows 95 in for this class, so everything's a little bit slower as a result. But a lot prettier, don't you think? Any questions, by the way, after the break, before we start on, about what we went through this morning as far as the general overview? Not in details, but just in feeling you understand the picture. Because now we're going to start to go into pieces of that picture and work our way down. The first one I want to go into is DNS. I go into DNS first because it's the one that exists only for us. It has no necessity to be there for the technology to allow computers to connect to each other. The whole reason it's there is it's a lot easier for me to remember esoft.com, AOL.com, than it is 199.45. Just like phone numbers. I don't remember a lot of phone numbers if I don't call them every day. If I want to call a company, I can remember the company's name pretty easy, but I've got no clue on the phone number without going to look it up. And human beings just operate like that. We want the same thing in our networks. We want to name things so we can remember them by name and hook to them by name. And the domain name system is the telephone book for the internet that lets us make that change from a name to the number that we need to have. Purpose of it, very clearly, is to humanize the internet. It also, once it's in place, allows us to treat email separately from directly connected computers. One of the things about having this extra layer here is that any layer you add is a layer that can fail. And one of the things you need to be aware of is that when it fails, it can look like something else broke. And you may not think to look here first. What does a DNS failure look like? Well, to an average user, the internet is broken. Or your computer is broken. You can't get to esoft.com. I can't, whatever. DNS treats email differently than a regular connection. So you may be able to FTP to esoft.com, but when you send email to esoft.com, it all bounces. And you don't know why. Well, you do know why, because ESOF's mailer's broken. That's your first reaction. It'll say something like, no host at this address, or give you some error message that makes it sound like the computer's down and broken. When in fact, the DNS is wrong. The third part, and the most subtle part, is what's called the reverse DNS. There is a special way of listing in the DNS that's just like the reverse phone book that we don't normally think of. It's existed for years, but if you're not in telemarketing and sales, you're not really aware of the reverse telephone book. But you can get one from the phone company, and what it says is, if you give me a phone number, I'll tell you whose number it is. So you can give me a phone number, and it says, oh, that's the number of Jay Jones, and here's his address. Just the backwards. I have a phone number, give me whose it is, versus I know who it is, give me their phone number, which is the normal phone book. Well, DNS has the reverse function, which says, if I only know 199.45.143.2, I can do a reverse lookup on it, and it will tell me that's esoft.com. However, the DNS really is only forward lookup. And the only way the reverse phone book is monitored is you actually have to write the reverse entries in as a separate process. It's not that you put it in forward and the system somehow automatically knows how to look it up backwards. You have to put in the forward listing and you have to put in the reverse listing as a separate activity. Very easy when you're thinking about it and putting it in to put in the forward one. That's what you know you're here to do. And forget to put in a reverse entry. Which means if somebody tries to look up your address reverse, the answer is it's not listed. It's an unlisted reverse address. Very subtle, because reverse DNS lookup is often used as a way to try to avoid people trying to be too anonymous or play cute tricks on the internet. It really doesn't provide much security, but it's very easy to do this, and a lot of software does it. And what a lot of software does on a lot of server sites is, when you telnet to it or FTP to it or whatever, it will look your address, it sees the IP address your packet's coming from. It does a reverse lookup on it to get the name, and if it says it's unlisted, it just disconnects you. It doesn't say anything, it just disconnects you. Some FTP servers will tell you why they're being disconnected. And some, they'll say something about it looks like you're spoofing an address. They'll say it in a way that misleads you, but they will say it. Looks like you're spoofing an address, talk to your administrator and get a real number and come back when you're not joking with me. Which makes you wonder what in the world is going on. So this effect of not having a reverse DNS can cause you to see problems that look like something else altogether. It's very subtle. I bring that up because we've seen in our tech support a lot of situations where people thought, you know, how come I can't telnet to this site or FTP this site? Or if I'm on the iPad console, I can go there, but if I'm over on my network from a workstation, I can't. And the answer is you put the reverse in for this one and you didn't put the reverse in for this one. But that's not what it looks like. It looks like, oh, but did I have routing wrong? What have I done wrong here? The answer is you just didn't put the reverse address in the DNS, and the system on the other end hangs up on you if it can't look you up. In DNS, as in everything in the internet, and I'm going to pound this because this one message I want you to get out of this class, it's everything in the internet is client-server. Can't be anything else. So when you want to know how something works, first trying to find out where the two parts are. Where's the client? Where's the server? There's always one of each. Every so often, they do what they do in DNS. The client is called a resolver. So they give it a funny name so that you kind of head fake you into not finding out that's the client. The DNS server is the server, but the DNS client is the resolver, because it resolves the name into a phone number. That's why it's named that. The domain name format, which you see a lot, name.name.name, has a very specific structure, and it works a lot like file directories on disk. This was an easier story to tell when everybody used DOS and you put the directory names in directly. Now you pop up and down them in little boxes and aren't as quite as related to that name/name/name structure of the tree directory on disk. But this is a tree directory the same way, except it's backwards. In a disk directory, this is the top, and then this is a subdirectory, if those were slashes. In this, this is the top, and it's right to left. Top level's on the right. Top level is also called the first level, and each level to the left is next lower. So you then end up with each level separated by a dot in the domain name. So this is the top level or first level, second level, third level, fourth level, and you have a lot of levels. The total length of the name has to be under 255 characters in length, and no single part of it can be more than 64 characters in length. We also have the @, which means we're dealing with email if we have an @, because the name always resolves to a single host computer. That name points to a single computer somewhere in the universe, one and only one. The @ divides the computer from the user. And what's on this side is the user ID on this computer. And that's the structure of a domain name. Now, it's important to know that because the central registry, a central registry, is always responsible for assigning the top levels, first and second level. For the domains .com, .edu, .gov, .org, and .net, for those five, it's the internic, which is run by forgot the name of the company, Network Services is it called, I think, in Arlington, Virginia, and basically started being funded by a U.S. government grant, now being funded by domain name fees. It's really in transition. It's still getting a certain amount of government money, but the idea is to wean it to be self-supporting over time and live off of its domain name application fees. For all other top-level domains, there is a registry. It's not the Internet. It's a different registry. Okay, yeah, put them on that table down there and go through the door at the end and talk to Kim. She's who you need to talk to. That'll probably be good on the tape. That was lunch is coming in, and Kim is who the lunches are for. So when you hear this tape, you'll know that the lunch has arrived. In any case, those registries, you have to find out the rules about how you apply. Each registry has its own set of rules. The major registries beyond those five are .mil for the military in the U.S., and the others are the country ones, .us, .whatever for a different country, .au for Australia, and each country has a .ca for Canada. And each one of those countries then has its own country registry. A central registry assigns those domain names. What that means is there is a process, which we'll get to in a little bit, whereby if you want a name in some top-level domain, you send some sort of an application to the registry that manages the names for that domain, asking for the name you want, and they'll give it to you or not, depending on whether you met the rules it takes to get that. For Internic, it's basically, the rules are simple. You can't ask for a name that somebody else already has. That's really why there's a registry, because names have to be unique. And it costs you $100 to get one, and that after 2 years, it'll cost you $50 a year. Once the registry has issued your name, it puts into the root servers run by the registry pointers to the name servers that you said was where you wanted this information to reside. You get to pick them. Probably they're your own, but they're whatever you pick. And there'll be two of them when you put them in your application, and that's what you've told the registry is going to be the authoritative name servers for this name if they grant it to you. So all they do is put in pointers to your servers. The operator of the domain name server that's registered as authoritative for a domain name assigns all names below the second level. That's how management of this large phone book is distributed. It's centralized by handing off who is authorized to say what this name means. Put a pointer to the machines that person says should be the management machines, and then the operator of that name server can do everything with that name from there on about what it means by editing files on his servers. Yes? Non-authoritative response says the system got confused. And here's a simple way it can get confused. Let us say, for example, that you sent in a request for a name, ESOFCOM, and you said these two machines are going to be authoritative for it. And then you didn't do anything. And they issued the name. And they put pointers to those machines in the registry. And now someone goes and looks up the name. It's going to go there, it's going to point to your machine, and it's going to say to your machine, okay, you're authoritative, tell me what's going on. And the machine says, this is the first I ever heard that I was supposed to know. That's what non-authoritative response means. It means the system pointed to a machine that was supposed to know, and when it went and looked, the machine didn't know. You will get non-authoritative response for anything that server is not authoritative for. It will only say it's authoritative for those things that you have made it authoritative for. And when we get to the end of this part of the class, I'll show you how that works, and we'll do some experiments that hopefully will help clear that up for you. It's a really pretty simple underlying concept when we get to it, and let me walk all the way through to it to see if we can clear it up as we go. If I haven't cleared it up when we get to the end, be sure I'll spend what time I need to, because it's what you're asking is a very core question about understanding DNS and managing it. Yes? A lame delegation means that it was a root server that said you were authoritative. Non-authoritative means you just went and asked directly and weren't told to go there by the root server. And we'll likewise reach what lame delegation means and why. What it ultimately means is that somewhere the server that's supposed to be authoritative for this name isn't. To understand this a little better, let's do a detailed walkthrough about how a full function resolver works. We'll ignore the fact for now that there aren't very many full function resolvers, because this lays the whole process out for you. The full function resolver starts out knowing nothing but a root server name. That's the I don't know anything but the number of directory assistants. And I have a name I need to know the phone number for. So the root server contacts, or the resolver contacts that root server, the one thing it just knows, and asks for DNS data for this name, esoft.com or whatever the name is it's trying to look up. The root server will really only look at the first and second level, even if I'm asking for lab.esoft.com or phil.lab.esoft.com. It's just going to look at those last two, because that's all it's really... it needs to know at this level, and it will return the names and IP addresses of the authoritative servers for that name, because that's what a root server knows, saying basically to the resolver, here's where you should go, and this should be the answer. They should know the answer. The resolver then disconnects from the root server and makes another query to one of these. It's called delegated servers, meaning the root server delegated your request to the servers that are supposed to know. Handed it off. The delegated server looks for the name in its DNS database, authoritative. If it's authoritative, it will have right on its machine the answer in a file for that name. And it returns the answer. Diagrammatically, this can look a little bit like this. The resolver asks the root server, I want to know lab.esoft.com. And the root server says, computer xyz.com knows. So the resolver then contacts xyz.com and says, tell me about lab.esoft.com. And xyz.com says, oh, lab.esoft.com equals 199.45.143.200. And now the resolver has the answer that this name is this address. That's the process of how DNS lookup works. Obviously, at every one of these steps, something can go wrong. And there's a symptom associated with failure at each part of it. First symptom is I can't contact the root server. That's pretty straightforward. It just sits there and grinds away and times out and can't do anything. Second symptom is it can't contact this server. That looks about the same. It gets a quick response that it's supposed to go here, goes out here, and just sits, and no answer comes back because it can't get there. The most common one is this server is registered as authoritative, but is not. Doesn't know a thing about esoft.com and lab.esoft.com. And what happens there is you get in a circle. Because this server, acting as a good server when asked about esoft.com, says, oh, I'm supposed to look this up. He goes and asks the root server, who points back to him. Yes, that's on the iPad, where you get to see every one of these processes. When that happens, it's very visible. Just stack them up. I'm in a circle. It's limited in the DNS to 8 times. If you've been in a loop 8 times, you indicate to the world that a lame delegation has occurred, to get back to your question. meaning I went in a circle 8 times and nobody claimed to know, and by now somebody's supposed to. So I have been delegated lamely to somebody who was supposed to know but didn't. That means that when what it looks like to a user is it'll time out and say, I can't find it, and they'll try again, being users. And they'll just keep at it. Yeah. So it'll stack up and stack up because they'll just keep trying it. For each try, it'll try 8 times. Yes, it has no memory of having failed just seconds ago. It'll do it all over again. Yes.
Systematically on iPad, if I say I send a piece of email to you and I see 7-8 DNS services running at one time, is that telling me that I have a DNS lane problem?
Any problem like that should show up in your log. It should be logged. There are some cases where certain names are delegated multiple levels deep, or where servers only provide part of the information and it has to recursively ask for other pieces. And it legitimately can stack up 4 or 5 or 6 to get one done. It's not normal, and it probably means somebody's done something on their machine that they could have done better. But it doesn't necessarily mean it won't work. Now we're going to look at what's called a stub resolver. This is the kind of resolver that exists in almost every client piece of software that runs on dial-up connections or Windows sockets, WinSock, those kind of things. It has a resolver in it that's a stub resolver. A stub resolver is basically the weakest kind of resolver you can build. It says, I really can't do the job myself. What I know is how to ask someone else to do it for me. That's why when you configure a system, you have to put in the address of a name server, which is not a root server. You're asking for a name server that will assist the stub resolver in doing its job. Because a stub resolver is supposed to, or a full resolver would do what we said before and would need to know nothing but a root server. But that's a lot more code and a lot more work, and stub resolvers are easy. They say there's big servers out there who will do this for me if I just beg and whine and throw myself on their mercy. And that's a stub resolver. And what a stub resolver does is ask any domain name server that's willing to be a server, and by the way, it's very hard to make one not be. Almost any name server that you point at will be usable by a stub resolver. That's why if you've ever had trouble with DNS and you just know somebody else's DNS server like Sprint's or your guy across town, your competitor, you can just have all your people use his domain name server by just giving your numbers to your dialers. This all network, client server, it has nothing to do with where you entered the network. It has nothing to do with who owns it. Remember the structure of the internet. If I want to use a DNS in Venezuela, because I'm here in Colorado, I just point to it. It certainly can. And later tomorrow, when we get into router and filtering classes, I'll show you how to make sure people can't do that to your server.
Is that also locked
up? We'll go through some of that tomorrow, yes. The domain name server that you ask first sees if it knows the name's information, and it can know it two ways. It may accidentally be authoritative for it. That's totally a coincidence because you didn't get there knowing it was, but it still might be. If you're pointed, for instance, to ESOF server and you're looking up ESOF.com, you happen to be using as your assist a server one that is authoritative for a couple of names, and if you happen to hit one of those names, it'll just say, here's the answer real quick out of my authoritative database. The other place it knows is a cache. Every time an assisting server looks something up, it will remember what it found for a certain length of time, and if somebody looks that same name up again, it doesn't have to do the whole process, it can just remember it from its cache. Does that for a certain length of time, and we'll go through how that is, how you know what that is a little bit later. If it finds the requested name data locally, then it just says, here it is. And it never gets past the stub resolver asking that server. Herein symptomatically lies some other symptoms that you can see. Let's say that people change what a DNS name, they move something from one computer to another, and the IP address for ESOFCOM changes, and we change it our DNS server. But we told before that people could cache the name for a week. They could remember it for a week. Everybody using, say, a server that once looked up ESOFCOM will get the old number for a week, and it'll look like ESOF's dead for a week until the cache expires and it has to go look it up again. We'll go through some of these things, how you can control them and what they tune, but right now what I'm trying to do is drop in when you see failures, how you can relate what part they might have come from and what they look like as well. Now, the other possibility is that this server's never been asked to look up this name, or it was asked long enough ago, it's forgotten, it's gone out of its cache. Then what it does is this server that has been asked by the stub resolver will follow this whole full resolver process that we looked at a moment ago and do the whole lookup from the root servers and down, get the name, give the answer back, and also put it in its cache in case it's asked again. Now we get to a DNS server. That was, we've looked at the world from the resolver side now. Full resolver does the whole function. A stub resolver just asks a server to do it for him, and he'll get an answer back. And the server has to figure out how to get that answer. So a DNS server then answers requests from resolvers. We now get to the concept of recursive and non-recursive requests, the part where if you ask the server for a name and it knows it locally, it gives it to you, and if it doesn't know it locally, it goes and does the whole process. It's actually an option in the request. A non-recursive request says, tell me the answer if you know it, and say you don't know. If you don't know it, don't look any farther. A recursive request, which is the normal kind done by a resolver, says, if you don't know it, I want you to go do everything you need to find it. So a non-recursive request asks only what this server knows, including possibly nothing. A recursive request is what causes the server, if it doesn't know it locally, to look up the tree and to the root servers and do all that and find out what the real answer is. Also, relative to a DNS server, an authoritative name server holds a portion of that distributed DNS database for the names it's authoritative for. If the server's authoritative for ESOFCOM, it will have a file, a database, that says what every name in ESOFCOM means. That the term for that file for a single name is the zone of authority. In DNS database terminology, that file that lists everything about one given name is called the zone of authority. And an authoritative name server then will hold the databases for the zones that it's authoritative for. Zone in this case means name and all subnames and all the pieces of whatever you've made that mean. DNS data is held in an ASCII file database at the level that you work with it. You're going to edit a file to put databases in. This database is the same on the iPad as it is on a Unix box, and it's commonly referred to as bind structure because the program on a Unix box that processes this file is called bind. And the format of the line is that you have the name, then you have a field, one or more spaces. The number of spaces here is unimportant. Those can be spaces or tabs. It's just break things apart with blanks. Time to live, number of seconds, data may be cached. We'll get back to what this means in a moment. Class, this is always the two letters, capital IN, as far as you're concerned. This was built as a big distributed database system by people who were saying, well, maybe something beside the internet will want to use this same directory. And so they said, we'll put these letters in here to say what kind of name it is, so we'll have other letters that mean, we could put whole parallel naming systems in the same system and use them at some time in the future. It's not done outside of some small laboratory areas, but you have to put the IN in there because of that. Then you have the type. And that's, what type of data is this? There are many kinds of data that can go with a name. SOA is start of authority, has administration info, says who's managing this database, what's the email address to send any, if I happen to find a problem with the name in here, who should I email to say, hey, you kind of screwed up your DNS file, you might want to fix it. It's got the name of the name server that the real physical database sits on. Because you can have multiple name servers, but the file itself is really only on one of them. The store of authority will list which server the actual physical editable file sits on. It also has some timing things. How often should I look for a secondary, if I'm a secondary to download, and we'll get into what these things mean in a minute. How long can I expire? Some general numbers about times of expiring and relooking for things. You have the A-type record. That's the IP address. Would say ESOFCOM, an A record in 199.45.143.2. Says if you're looking up the address for ESOFCOM, this is what it is. MX, mail exchange. That says if you're trying to email, this tells you where to send it. NS, name of authoritative name servers. This is a list of what servers are supposed to be authoritative for this name. It allows you to prove that the whole thing's together by being in the right places. PTR is used for the reversed lookup, and we'll get into that in more detail. After a PTR, you'd have a name, and this would be the reverse address, and this would be the name that went with it. CNAME is because human beings are doing this, and human beings like nothing more than to make aliases for things and really build Baroque complicated structures that even they are confused by shortly thereafter. CNAME is confusing in and of itself. It's clearly made up by a computer scientist. It means canonical name. Alias. When you see CNAME, think alias. What it means is, if it says esoft.com cname phil.com, it means you wanted to look up esoft.com. Well, that's really an alias for phil.com. Just forget what you were doing. Go back and look it all up again as phil.com. That way I can alias names to other names.
Phil?
Yeah.
The top-level server, the internet, assigns the names down to the second level. So
yes.
Why is there a conflict with that if you can then just go into your and give it whatever name you want?
Well, you would have to have that name assigned to you, or it would never get to you to look it up. But, for instance, let us say that I applied for a name esoft.com, and I had another name, phil.com, and it was all set up on my server. Early on, I may just want those to be aliases for each other. So I would simply go in and make a zone of authority for phil.com that just said phil.com, cname, esoft.com. Because I'm authoritative for both, I can do it. I could also decide that my name esoft.com should point to the MIT computers. I'm authoritative for ESOP. I could CNAME it to a whole bunch of stuff I'm not authoritative for. That's okay, too. So you basically can do whatever you want to do. The point of this is to let human beings have the flexibility to do what they want. When you have that much flexibility, you have plenty of flexibility to do things you didn't mean to and to do things that are inherently stupid. But the point is that, yeah, you can't because you can do them. You normally don't want to. It's giving you the flexibility, though, to take these names and treat them the way you want. And when you get names, you tend to just want often to have names be aliases for other names. Or you may, for instance, I may have a situation here at ESOF where I want to set up a Phil Becker web page. And it's on our server here at work. And it's on the server www.esoft.com. But I happen to have my domain, plb.com. And I really want www.plb.com. But I don't want to put another server up for it. So I might just CNAME that to esoft.com so that you could click www.plb.com and it would take you to the ESOF server, for example. That's not a real good example. There's a lot better reasons you would want to use aliasing, but that gives you an idea of what the aliasing is all about. It's just to make one name mean another. Yes?
So we have a user out there that wants to have their own domain name. Is it possible for, say, my iPad to to kind of assign that the way the internet would assign one to me?
The question is, on if you have a user that wants their own domain name, can you assign it to your user the way the internet would assign it to you? Effectively, the answer is yes, but it doesn't happen that way. What you do is you go and apply to the internet for your user to get that name. And you point your iPad as the authoritative server for that name. And then you put in the zone of authority anything you want, pointing it to your own machines. So you manage it for your user in that way. You obtain the name and you manage the name for your user, and then, but it still has to be, if it's a new second level name, it has to go to the registry to be registered. If you wanted, on the other hand, to create a name under yours, you had esoft.com and you wanted to make user.esoft.com and you wanted him to be user.esoft.com, you just do that, because you already have that name and you're just adding on under it. If you want a new second level, though, you have to go back to the registry and build a whole separate structure.
Is there a limit
to
the number of subnames you can go down?
There's no limit to the number of subnames, but the total length of the name cannot be longer than 255 characters, and no single name in it can be longer than 64. But how many layers you do, no. As you can see by some of the names out there, there's not a limit. There's some of these that are pretty outrageous.
But your DNS database, is there a limit to how big your DNS database?
Your DNS database can be as big as it needs to be.
The bigger, the longer it takes to look at.
No.
Okay.
No. The question was, if your DNS database gets bigger, does it take longer to look things up? No, it does not. It's all indexed, so it doesn't. It's just as quick no matter how big it gets. Yes. If that's true, it's a registry limit, not a technical limit. And I don't know of that limit, but I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised by it. But it would be a limit imposed by the registry. The technical structure of the internet allows those names to be up to 64 at any level. Yes. Yeah, you. I'm sorry.
Are we going to get any experience on writing those DNS?
Absolutely, you are. Yes, you will. You'll get that right after lunch. We'll be doing serious DNS development work, understanding work, and training. What I'm doing now is laying the groundwork for the terminology, the theory, the general thing, and then we're going to sit down and we're going to work with it. Because this is one of the two most critical management functions you do when you're on the internet, and it's one of the things that you just have to understand. Because if you don't understand the domain name system, your life will not be good. You'll be lost, you'll be confused, and things will never work the way you think they should, and it'll all be because you don't know how to write these files. Well, we'll go through that. Yes.
So, is this
where
redirect files
come
in now or later?
Redirect files?
On the
RED
files.
Oh, no, that's a totally separate thing. That doesn't have anything to do with this. They can be used in conjunction with aliasing on the web server, but that doesn't directly have anything to do with this. Question was, the redirect files in the web server on the iPad, do they apply here? And the answer is no. They apply as yet another way to play more aliasing tricks with the web server itself, but not with the DNS. Here's an example resource record from a DNS database that would define the IP address for lab.esoft.com and allow that to be remembered by anybody who looked it up to 24 hours. By the format, here's the name, here's the time to live, 86,400 seconds. And if somebody wants to work that out of the calculator, that's how many seconds there are in 24 hours. Then we have the class. This is an internet class record, very literally actually today. A, for this is an address record, and then this is the address. The other kind of record that you get into is a mail exchange record. And we're going to do some work on this as well, in which we look at how these work, and you can do a lot of sophisticated things with mail, and so you have a structure that's more sophisticated than you usually need it to be. But we'll understand it, hopefully, by the time we're done, to where you can understand why it's the way it is and how you can do some simple things with it. The data field in an MX record has a decimal preference number. Now, the first question that comes up, is this golf or is this baseball? Is a bigger number better or is a lower number better? And this is golf. The smaller the number, the higher the priority, the more important. It's more important if it has a littler number. And these numbers go from 0 to 255. Multiple MX records can be used to define redundant mail delivery. We'll show you some examples of that. Let us say you receive so much email that one machine can't handle it. And you've got a lot of email coming in, and you just know one machine is never going to be able to handle all this email coming in. So you put two machines up. So you put two MX records up to say mail can go to either one of these machines. And then if it tries one, and if it can't get on that one, it tries the other one. The other reason you might put two up is, let's say that the machine you normally have mail on, you take it out of service every evening for 3 hours to do something. You take it down for maintenance or whatever. But you don't want email to stop coming in while you got that machine down. So you have another machine that you want to take mail, but you really only want it to take mail when this one's down. In that case, you'd give them different preference numbers. The most important or lowest preference number would go to where you normally want the mail to go. The lower preference number would go to the overflow machine that gets mail when this one's down. Now, another magic thing happens. This one gets mail, but it's not the destination. So it looks and says, oh, there's a better place to send mail than me. It has a lower priority number. So it will constantly take that mail and automatically try to send it down the line to the higher priority one. So 3 hours later, when you bring this machine up, it'll dump across all the mail that it got while the machine was down. There's a lot more that you can do with MX records, but that's the general concept of why it's the way it is. Again, remember, delivery begins the lowest preference number. It proceeds to the highest until mail can be delivered. Here's an example. I want mail to go to machine mail1.esoft.com if it possibly can, because it's got the lowest preference number. I want it, if it can't go there, I'd like it to go here next. And if it can't go to either of these two, then I want you to send it to this machine. And that's literally what that means. Now, behind the scenes, I will have worked out the reasons why this is the order for me. I may have this machine send it to that machine, or I may have this machine dump it to someplace else. You know, that's all up to me to work out. But after I've put together my structure, I've kind of worked out that I really want it to go here if it can. If it can't go here, I want it to go here. And if it can't go here as a last resort, I'll take it there. Yes?
Does that mean mail to bill@lamb.esoft.com will go to mail1.esoft.com?
Absolutely, that's what it means. Yes. If you send mail to phil@lab.esoft.com, it will attempt first to actually send the mail to this machine, second to send it to this machine, and third to send it to this machine.
We do that so that you could have an address on lab.esoft.com, but it not actually be running any kind of mail hosting.
Classic example of that is phil.becker@esoft.com will send email to me at my house. But esoft.com's machine is here because it's rerouted to phil.esoft.com, a different machine. And this is why mail is so much fun, because it can get as complex as you want it to, and there are people who thrive on making it non-understandable. They aren't happy if they haven't handled a piece of mail 20 times from one side of the room to the other. And if a thunderstorm happens, it should take a different route. And there are legitimate reasons for all this, but it can get very complicated. The trick here is that at the level of setting up your DNS, You have the ability to do this kind of prioritization and to have multiple possible responses. If this one, if you only had one line in here, then that would be, if mail goes there. If it can't go there, it'll try again later until it can go there. But you can set up these things so that you don't leave the poor person on the other end holding the mail. You take it somewhere. Yes.
So what I infer that if you had two different, let's say Phil at lab ESOP and you had Joe at lab ESOP, could send those to different mail groups.
At the DNS level, you cannot do that. At the DNS level, you cannot do that. That's where you get into another capability, which is you send it to a machine that is not the end of the line, but has some kind of gateway software that reads the pieces and starts sending out the messages to different places based on the username. That's where you fake there being users all on one machine that actually are on different machines. You have to do that with a piece of software that actually receives the mail and then resends it. Well, no, that's not a POP server. That's actually a separate piece of software called a mail forwarding gateway. Pardon? An SMTP gateway with a mail forwarding capability. SMTP gateways can also be conversions. For instance, an SMTP gateway could convert it to MS mail or CC mail, could make a format change as well. This is the function of forwarding is just a mail forwarder. It's a program that receives all the mail for a certain name, certain domain name, and scans the usernames and turns those into being resent back out to a lot of different places based on the name. Yes.
So your DNS mail handler is going through stuff at the DNS.
Yes. All of DNS. That's a key question. The question was, so the DNS is for only the stuff after the at sign, and the answer is absolutely yes. The domain name service knows nothing about the name before the at sign. Remember, the name after the at sign designates a computer. The point of domain name service is to turn a name into a computer. The name before the at sign is a user on that computer. And what we're talking about with concepts like mail forwarding gateways is where you want to appear to have users all on one computer when they're really not. And the only way you can do that at this level is one computer really has to receive all the mail. And then it decides this is really for...